I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to Rory Sutherland's On Brand, brought to you by Alf Insight. In each episode, we'll talk to the big names from the world of advertising, marketing and media to dissect and debate success, ingenuity and the future possibilities for our industry. And today, I'm delighted to say I'm joined by Nikki Garg. Nikki is the co-founder of the Good Pea Company, producing plant-based milk with the dual aims of being good for you and also good for the planet. So I think that's the second plant-based milk company we've actually had on the show. Some years ago, we actually welcomed the marketing director of Oatly. Nikki this time is producing pea-based milks rather than oat-based milk. So Nikki, welcome to the podcast. Now, the first question people are going to ask is, how on earth do you get milk from peas? And I guess we should point out that you're not talking about the standard green variety of pea that you find in, for example, mushy peas, or which you find in, you know, the conventional supermarket. It's a different kind of pea, is that right?
Yes, you're absolutely right. So it's not the green variety, but actually the yellow split pea, which is the legume. And when we started out our mission to make a positive change in the world, it was at the start of the pandemic, and we wanted to make a really positive impact on people's health and the planet. And we realized that the biggest way that we could do that was to make a plant-based product, because statistically, we know that a plant-based diet is the single biggest way to reduce our carbon footprint. My husband also has a dairy allergy, and actually 68% of the world is lactose intolerant to some degree. And so that's why we focused on the plant milk sector. And we thought, if you can get milk from oats, nuts, rice, soybeans, then why not yellow split peas? And it was really important to us, actually, that we created something that was nutritious and tasty, as well as sustainable and long life. And we wanted to be as inclusive as possible. So although we are a vegan product, we're not just here for vegans, we're absolutely here for everyone. And even though milk is not as sexy, I guess, as say something like chocolate, there is something really nostalgic about drinking milk as children. And most of us have quite fond memories of milk and cookies. But it's quite tainted now that we know dairy is one of the biggest contributors of carbon emission. It actually has double the impact of aviation, whereas pea milk has up to 86% less carbon emissions than dairy. And so with the Good Pea Co, I guess we're saying you can have your milk and cookies and feel good about it.
So I understand also that the plants themselves are actually quite beneficial to the environment, because they kind of require less in the way of fertilization or artificial fertilizer, because they can actually extract nitrogen from the atmosphere. Is that right?
That's correct, yes. At the beginning of our journey, something that was quite a key contributor in us choosing yellow split peas as our hero ingredient was me coming across a TED talk by Julia Albrecht called How Peas Will Save the Planet. And in that, we discovered that field peas, so whether they're green, yellow, or dried peas, they have this capability of taking nitrogen from the air and using a bacterial in the soil called rhizobia. And that allows it to convert it into a usable form for crops to grow. And therefore, you don't require any artificial nitrogen fertilizers, which in turn keeps our lakes and oceans cleaner. So I guess that was a bit of a eureka moment for me. And I remember calling my friend who was going through a similar journey towards veganism at the time, and kind of rather cheesily said, you know, do you want to help me save the world? And we became business partners, and I guess the rest is history.
Did you become a vegan, in fact?
It was during the first lockdown, so 2020, and I, historically, my whole life, I had eaten meat quite a lot, and I hadn't really thought about it too much, but marrying my husband, who's always been vegetarian, I was starting to think about it a little bit more, and also a little bit out of laziness, not wanting to have to cook two meals every day. I was probably eating more vegetarian meals over the years. And then during the first lockdown, I think I became quite philosophical, I think like a lot of people did, about, you know, why COVID was happening and, you know, have we caused this? What kind of impact are we having on the earth, on animals? And I actually watched Game Changers at a similar time. And I kind of realized, actually, I think veganism is for me, and I want to try to live by a plant-based diet. And just kind of made the switch overnight, really.
And the really funny thing about plant-based milks is because they've actually emerged on the shelves relatively recently. And it's fair to say oat milk only does date back to about 1990. I think it was invented at the University of Lund by a professor there. The other forms of plant-based milk, for example, almond milk, soy milk, actually date back to the 13th century, or at least they're probably much older than that, but those are the first written references to them. I think there's a mention of, if I'm right, almond milk in the form of curry, which is F-O-R-M-E and C-U-R-Y, which I think might be the earliest cookbook in the English language. It was produced by, I think, chefs at the court of Richard II. And this came as an absolute kind of revelation to me, that these plant-based milks are not a newfangled thing. They're actually extremely old. But on the other hand, one thing you will point out is you think there is an environmental problem with almond milk in terms of water consumption.
There is, yeah. I mean, there's quite a few environmental concerns with a lot of the milks. And by the way, we're a huge fan of plant milks in general, in the sense that, you know, what they're contributing to the plant-based industry, and plant milks will always be better than dairy in terms of sustainability anyway. But if we kind of look at them a little bit closely, then almond milks they have a lot of water consumption. So it actually takes 1.1 gallons of water to grow a single almond, which is huge. Rice milk is quite similar. And then, you know, from the kind of oat milk and coconut milks and things like that, they're not too bad in terms of sustainability. But from a nutritional point of view, you'll often find oat milks, they won't have very much protein in them. They might be quite high in carbohydrates, in sugar, and coconut milks can be quite high in saturated fat as well. So it's kind of getting the balance between being really sustainable and nutritious.
And the protein content is what really distinguishes the yellow pea, I suppose. Yeah, that's very, and of course, I suppose that's more important, because the danger of veganism is the danger of vegetarianism is that your diet ends up a bit carb heavy or cheese heavy in the case of vegetarians, I suppose. So anything that kind of counterbalances that is useful. Would you say that as a vegan, you do need to kind of meal plan, that it's not something you can do simply by kind of, cutting out meat and dairy from your diet and then going as the mood takes you? Does it require some degree of kind of food balancing or supplements or something of that kind?
I think we've moved so far forward from kind of the old myth of vegans sort of just live on salads and lettuce leaves. There are so many alternatives out there now, and a lot of them are fortified with the things that you will get mainly from animal products, for example, vitamin B12. Having said that, you know, there are so many things that you, nutrients that you get from plants, which are beneficial more so than animal products. But yes, I do think, you know, I think everybody should meal plan whatever kind of diet you adhere to. But with veganism, you probably have to take a little bit of extra care in terms of making sure that you do get that B12 in your diet and iron and the protein. But there are so many natural things as well in a vegan diet, you know, legumes, beans, lentils, and actually the yellow split pea. I mean, I come from an Asian background, and so we've always known it known to use it in curries and in our dals, and that's always a staple in an Indian household because it's very high in protein and it gives you that kind of balanced diet. So it wasn't something that was alien to us, but it was just using that, and instead of making a curry, I guess milking it and turning it into something else that we could use that was, you know, very nutritious. And all of our protein actually comes from the pea. We haven't had to add anything into our product. So each carton of our original SKU, which is 1 liter, has 34 grams of protein in it, which is unrivaled on the market at the moment. And it actually has 50% more calcium than cow's milk. So, you know, it's interesting when a lot of people will say, well, if you cut out your, you know, your milk, your cow's milk, then where will you get your calcium from? Well, actually, you're getting more from drinking our milk, so you don't need to worry about that. And we've also fortified it with B12, iodine, which is very important for brain function, and vitamin D as well. And I think probably most of the UK is deficient in vitamin D, so it's very important to add that in.
I think you get your peas from Belgium, actually. Although they're grown very extensively in Asia, you choose to get them from nearby in Belgium. Is that right?
That's correct, yes. It would be a lot cheaper for us, actually, to, you know, get the peas from China, even Canada, but we've chosen to go with Belgium. They produce a real pure pea protein isolate that gives us that high level of protein, and it's as close to home as we could find at this stage. And so we're just trying to minimize, you know, supply chain impact as much as possible. And we also use a supplier that chooses farmers that are really close to their production sites. The pea processing site as well consumes 39% of self-produced drinking water. And we've taken it, you know, throughout every part of the journey. We've really tried to think about the environment, you know, right through to packaging as well. We use a packaging that is 100% recyclable. Our milks are long life, so hopefully that will cause less wastage as well.
So yours is an interesting case of a lockdown-inspired entrepreneurial idea. You were working in finance before, is that right?
I was, yes. I spent the last 12 years in banking and finance. So it was really quite a career change. But I think for the first time in my career that I'm doing something really meaningful and that I can look back and say, well, I did something that can help future generations, you know, both from a kind of planet friendly point of view and also from a nutritional point of view. And also, you know, being inclusive was very important to me, seeing my husband struggle with his dairy allergy and having to constantly check the back of packs and if he's going to restaurants, or, you know, really making sure there's no dairy and things, but then missing out on the nutrients, you know, that. And looking into that further now, having had children, you know, I came to realize that actually 2 children out of every classroom in the UK have allergies, and a lot of them are dairy. And so it kind of felt very unfair to me that because you can't eat something that you should have to sacrifice on the nutrients.
Worldwide, actually, the proportion of people who are lactose intolerant includes quite a large proportion of the Asian population, if that's right, I think.
I don't know the kind of breakdowns per continent. I know it's 68% of the world is lactose intolerant to some degree. So some will feel it as maybe mild bloating, others will get more severe reactions to it. But it kind of makes you think that, you know, drinking cow's milk is probably not very natural. We probably shouldn't be drinking another mammal's milk.
It's very recent evolutionarily, because I think it was something like a mutation in 25,000 years ago in India, which they think then spread, which is the ability for humans to digest milk above early childhood age, I think. And if you can think about it, in a sparse environment, there would have been an advantage to getting children to move on from the breast at a certain age, possibly. But it's certainly, you know, in terms of the time span of human evolution, it's kind of almost a last minute adaptation. The ability to digest cow's milk, therefore, came with it, I think. But obviously, you know, I take your point that actually the idea that milk is a natural food is perhaps one that isn't quite as safe as we like to think. When you got started, you must have done all your research under lockdown conditions, kind of contacting suppliers, packaging, etc. We were still under lockdown and you were effectively doing that remotely, finding out.
Yes, yeah.
And are you the first pea-based milk provider in Britain, at least? I know in Asia it's got a longer history.
No, we're not. We're not the first. However, our USPs are really around nutrition. So we're unrivaled in terms of the level of protein that we have in our milks and, you know, just our supply chain. And also, and I know this is very subjective, but, you know, we feel that we've got a superior taste as well, which is quite important. I think when you're picking something, especially if you've been used to drinking cow's milk, you know, your whole life, and you're looking for something that is substituting, you're trying to make all the right decisions for the environment, etc. But you've got to enjoy your food and choose something you can really work with. And I think, you know, the pea protein market is vastly growing, and I think there's space for, you know, everyone. It's set to be 178 million over the next 5 years in terms of the global pea protein market. And so I think there are lots of oat milks out there, lots of different brands. There are a couple of different pea protein milks out there at the moment, and I think we'll probably see a lot more of that, not just in drinks but also in food as well. We already get pea protein burgers and sausages and things like that, and I think we'll just see that range grow and grow and grow because of all the benefits that you can get from the peas.
It seems to have been a kind of an overlooked plant. I mean, obviously we eat peas, there's nothing that weird about that. But the versatility of that particular plant seems to have been sort of strangely lost to us, particularly given the protein content you mentioned. So I'm very grateful for you for kind of reviving interest. How did you get started in terms of looking at marketing and distribution? What were your first thoughts? What was your natural first approach to where you sold it first and how you promoted it?
It was a really interesting journey, actually, because when we first started, we did face quite a lot of challenges. Personally, having like common startup challenges and also having, you know, the pandemic having its own challenges as well. So initially, Sue and I, my co-founder, neither of us come from a food and beverage market. And so, you know, we found ourselves in this situation where we had this sort of passion project and we wanted to convert it into a serious product, a disruptor on the market. And that came with quite a lot of challenges itself, because at every part of the journey, there was a lot of unknowns, there's a real lack of experience, quite often imposter syndrome. And we were very green, excuse the pun, but and so, you know, on the technical side of things as well, we had to very quickly surround ourselves with people who could fill our knowledge gaps and that we could trust explicitly. And then, of course, you have the kind of common challenges that most startups face, which is essentially getting the business off the ground, gaining traction, boosting brand awareness, working, you know, on the right marketing strategy and who we wanted to supply to and how we wanted to distribute. And then we had the pandemic, which brought its own challenges. So normally when you're formulating a new recipe, you'd be able to go to a lab and spend, say, a day there. And by the end of the day, you've come up with lots of different variations of that product and you decide this is the one. Whereas for us, because it was locked down and the labs were, you know, shut for long periods of time, we were having to create a recipe, wait for it to be posted to us, try it, go back with a change and do that, which probably delayed us for about 6 to 8 months actually in our process. So it kind of really required a lot of belief in our product and determination at every hurdle. But Sue and I are very, every time we come up with a problem, we think, well, where there's a will, there's a way, and we always find one. And so through a lot of perseverance and leaning on people that are really good at what they do, we kind of thought, well, initially, I think, you know, the best thing for us to do is really focus on our USPs and what is different in a market that is highly competitive. As you say, oat milks and almond milks are still hugely popular in the UK. And so we had to really think about how we were different and get that message across in our marketing from a nutritional point of view, from a sustainability point of view, and then think about who we wanted to supply to. And we've kind of gone with health and fitness centers that seemed very appropriate for what we were doing, you know, hotels that are really focused on healthy living, plant-based living. And also we are speaking now to kind of the next generation students who want to, you know, incorporate more of a plant-based lifestyle, you know, in and around London predominantly at the moment, and also retailers that are kind of on the higher end at the moment in terms of quite luxurious retailers that really understand, you know, what we're doing and enable us to get our message out there. But we, you know, our end goal really is to be as accessible as possible to as many people. So we would love to continue our journey and expand into as many retailers as possible and across Europe, really.
It's not a bad idea from a branding point of view, actually, to start with high end. I understand you just signed a deal with one prestigious London department store, which we can't name. But it's not a bad idea to be first distributed through those before you go more mainstream, because it sends a kind of brand message, I think. You know, people look to those stores to some extent for high quality, for their curation of high quality and innovative products. And so launching there, in a sense, does double duty. It not only gets you sales, but it kind of does a positioning job as well, which I think is useful. So, I mean, that's, you know, I think you've been fortunate or it's very, very intelligent in that approach to starting with sort of select and niche retailers. And then I suppose the dream is wider distribution down the line. You do have a website and sell direct, but I mean, my hunch would be, I mean, there will be a group of people who order direct, but in that mainstream physical distribution is still the thing for most liquid products, I would argue.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you can order. We do have people that are very loyal to us and they've set up a subscription on our website. But yes, I think, you know, when you're doing your grocery shopping and you're in the supermarket or using an online order, I think most people like to just, it's a lot more convenient to be able to order all from one place, isn't it? So essentially, yes, we are looking to expand and we're having some really positive conversations with a few retailers at the moment. So yeah, watch this space.
I mean, obviously, coffee shops would be another market. From what I remember from my own experiments, it works very well in coffee, doesn't it?
Yes, so we do have a barista version at the moment. We have the two SKUs. So the original, which I mentioned, has all the fortifications. And then we've got the barista, which is the one you tried, Rory. And that one is specifically for teas and coffees, because a lot of the plant milks out there at the moment tend to split in coffees because coffee is very acidic. And that's not the most attractive thing when you're drinking coffee. And so we really focused on that to create something that froths really well. And we actually tried it with various different professional baristas across London. And they were hugely impressed and said, our milk's actually the closest plant milk to frothing similarly to cow's milk. And so we were quite pleased with that. And so we do have that. And we are, again, in talks with a few coffee shops. We are in a couple of places that are independents at the moment. And yeah, it would be absolutely fantastic if we could get more coffee shops on our journey with us as well.
It's also perfect because I think the people who are either lactose free or indeed vegan are probably still looking for another alternative to the standard sort of triad. I guess the standard triad is soy, oat, almond or coconut, I guess, is the fourth one, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
Rice milk seems to have slightly disappeared. I used to buy a rice milk called Rice Dream about 10 years ago. I mean, the one headwind you face, I suppose, which the dairy industry also faces, is that it's less common now for people to drink milk as a drink in a glass. And also, I suppose, breakfast cereal consumption, which was always the other great, you know, driver of milk consumption, seems to be a little bit in decline. You know, the bog standard nature of kind of breakfast cereal as the staple of your breakfast doesn't seem to be. So there is a little bit of a headwind around milk as a wider category. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think what people are doing is using it in different ways. So I think at the moment, overnight oats are just hugely popular, aren't they? And so, you know, our milk works great in that you can really substitute it for anything that you would with normal milk, whether it's, you know, teas, coffees or bechamel sauces for your pasta or coconut curries or whatever, you know, whatever you want to do with it, you really can swap it out. And I think, you know, yes, people are drinking it less by the glass. I think children still do. And our original is very popular with children. Often when we go to markets and exhibitions and we do a lot of sampling, we always have children asking for more, which is great. And my kids do. My kids will just have it by the glass and keep asking for more, which is good.
Yeah, let me vouch for this. I've tried the product and I think it is actually really delicious, both on its own and, as you said, the barista product works disproportionately well, I think, in tea and coffee as a substitute. Because my wife is, well, or claims to be, lactose intolerant. And she kind of splits between lacto-free milk, the Arla product, and some plant-based milk. Tends to have plant-based milk in coffee shops because they don't offer lacto-free milk. And I think you have absolutely happened on something significant. The useful thing also about having the barista product is that people, I think, instinctively would think a pea-based milk would work less well in coffee. And so actually specifically naming a product as a barista product overcomes that kind of natural assumption. And of course, the other thing we shouldn't forget, which is one of my other reasons for buying plant-based milk as someone who's neither vegan nor lactose intolerant, is shelf life. So it doesn't need to be refrigerated, does it? In fact, it might be a good idea to get supermarkets to stock it in the fridge, simply because there's a quality association. You know, we tend to think things that aren't in the fridge, long life milk, for example, is kind of rubbish. I mean, that was the famous thing with Sunny Delight, that drink that P&G created, which is they demanded it was sold in the fridge, even though, to be honest, it required no refrigeration at all. But you do have there's a food waste message there, I think. I mean, obviously, you know, once open, you do have to consume it within, what, 6 days, 7 days or something like that, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, it'll probably last until 7 days. We've put, 5 days on the packaging just to be safe. But before you open it, yes, it can be stored just in ambient temperatures. You can just put it in your pantry. You can stock up. They're quite kind of slick, tall cartons as well, so they don't take up a lot of space. And, you know, from manufacturing date, the shelf life is 12 months as well. So, yeah, you know, another thing to really help, with wastage. And again, it was something that was quite poignant, you know, starting in the pandemic, and everybody was rushing out to stock up on, you know, toilet rolls and pasta and this and that. And it was one of those things to say, well, you know, milk is one of those everyday items that you really need. And so if there is ever a shortage, you kind of, you know, it's quite useful to have some long life milk, you know, that is nutritious, low in wastage, super sustainable, that you have just stored somewhere in your house.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Do you do any advertising? I mean, whether online or off?
We use social channels quite a lot at the moment. So, you know, Instagram is proving quite good for us. We're building a really organic following via that, and Facebook as well. And really, we've had quite a lot of success with word of mouth, although, you know, that is quite a long process. But yes, but they're the kind of main things we've been focusing
It's helped in part that the vegan community are a kind of tribe who will look to help each other out, I suppose, at this current moment. You know, I always think there's a moment in the development of certain practices or beliefs where the group is unusually cooperative and collaborative. It's a bit like that. Electric cars are like that at this stage. They're rare enough where people feel that they're part of the electric car tribe, and they will automatically be fairly civil and helpful towards other people. I always worry, you know, what will behavior at charging stations be like when it's no longer a tribe? I don't quite know. But I think you are helped by that in terms of just word of mouth and social channels.
Yeah, I think the vegan community is huge for us, and also the allergy community as well, because, you know, whenever someone stumbles across a product that is, you know, doesn't contain the top 14 allergens, it's quite rare. There's more and more great brands that are emerging now that have that, but it just means that it's safer for more people to drink, and especially kind of young families as well, where people are looking for milks that their children can drink and still get the nutrients that other children in the classroom or nursery are drinking. So that's been hugely beneficial for us. And we've been exhibiting at, you know, trade shows and things as well. So we did the London Excel, the V show in July, and we're about to do the Veg Fest in London Olympia in November, actually a couple of weeks away. And so again, you know, people are always pleasantly surprised by the taste, because I think you're right, when people initially, you know, see pea milk, they think of the vegetable and they think, is it going to taste like peas? Is it going to taste quite earthy? But I'm quite proud of what we've done with it. And it's always nice to get that reaction, that pleasant reaction, to think, oh, this is actually very different to what I thought, and I really love this. So,
well, that's fun. And you're also helped, I suppose, because this is a really extraordinary time for food tech. And that, by what I mean food tech, I mean both foods themselves, things like, for example, meat substitutes, where there seems to be a kind of massive forward leap in the quality of kind of a veggie burger over the last 5 years. But also there's this kind of revolution going on in the distribution of food, in that you have the Gustos and the Hello Freshes coming in, which might be a potential distribution mechanism for you, of course, you know, if they've got spare space in the box. You've also got these kind of restaurants that are effectively creating kind of Michelin-starred meals almost, and delivering them overnight. The pandemic undoubtedly, I think it was going to happen anyway, if I'm being honest about it. But what, you know, it was rather like video conferencing or the QR code. The pandemic massively accelerated behavioral change and resulting innovation in terms of how people cook and eat and prepare food, and also how they buy it. So, I mean, Ocado would be another distribution opportunity for you, I guess.
100%. Yeah, all of those things are things that we've considered, and we're in, you know, conversation with a lot of those people at the moment. And yeah, there is so much opportunity. I think people are really looking for something that we kind of fit the bill in terms of just being really convenient, just being on their doorstep, and kind of being long life as well. There's a really great vegan meal kit that's come out as well, called Grubby, and we're working quite closely with them. So a lot of their customers have or will be in the next few days receiving samples of our milk in their packages as well. And they're essentially the kind of fully plant-based version of HelloFresh and Gusto. So, you know, that there's lots of opportunities, and lots of we're a very collaborative brand, and so there's lots of opportunity for us to continue working with all these other great brands as well, and kind of really pushing our message out.
Yeah, I mean, I'll echo a message for all the listeners here, which I entirely agree with Mark Ritson, which is that brand partnerships are ridiculously underexplored. And I always used to get a bit annoyed by this, because you'd occasionally hear, I think advertising agencies didn't like brand partnerships because, of course, they were a way of obviating the need for advertising to some degree. But you'd often get this daft phrase, which is, oh, I don't like brand partnerships, they dilute your brand. Which, as I said, is a bit like saying that having friends dilutes your personality. You know, I don't think people's minds work like that at all. I think they're highly complementary and symbiotic when they're done. Obviously, they have to be done well, and they can't be entirely irrelevant. But I think those kind of symbiotic brand partnerships can actually literally be a case of 1 + 1 = 3. And of course, cost remarkably little. So you both end up benefiting essentially from something which is generally comparatively inexpensive. So, I mean, the more of those you'd look for, I mean, the better. I wouldn't rule out conventional advertising. I mean, get the distribution first. Obviously, you have to reach, you know, distribution, some level of distribution before I think mainstream advertising will pay, unless you're using the advertising to secure the distribution, of course. But I certainly wouldn't rule that out. I think there is a kind of efficiency-effectiveness trade-off here, which is that a lot of people have learned that you can efficiently, at some level, promote yourself using online media and social media, and so you should. I'm not disputing that for a second. But sometimes I think you have to accept that to reach the kind of, you know, relevant scale, and also to discover target audiences you don't anticipate in advance, there is a value to mass bought media. And I think we've slightly lost sight of that, that, you know, fundamentally, you know, for all the virtues of other forms of engagement, you know, mass bought media obtains and achieves things which, you know, nothing else can. And for as long as that's still true, I think there's still a really important place for it. But I mean, it's also interesting, I think, to note, just a psychological observation of mine, that a lot of people who leave banking and finance, we've got a brewery around the corner from us, which again was founded kind of by recovering bankers. And I think it's interesting that if you work in something intangible, there's a particular delight. You know, if you spent 10 or 11 years working effectively with numbers and with intangibles, there's a particular delight and satisfaction that comes from finally producing a physical product. And that must be rewarding to you.
Oh, 100%. Yes. And in my previous roles, I actually did work with quite a lot of business owners of varying degrees, some startups, some very well established. And so, yes, I was like doing, you know, I was doing the number crunching for them. But it was always fascinating to me to hear their stories, their backgrounds. And like you say, see a physical product come to life from an idea off the page. And so, you know, I absolutely think it's the best decision I've made. And I, you know, it's useful. There's a lot of skills that I honed over the years that have been useful in setting up this business. But I've never quite felt this kind of rewarded in what I'm doing as I do now.
Absolutely fantastic. I mean, huge congratulations. Any plans for export? Likewise, I mean, I'd have to ask this question, given your peas come from Belgium. Has Brexit affected you in any way?
It did, yes, especially when we were, it was another challenge that we faced when we were formulating the recipe, actually, because at customs, we often had things kind of going back and forth between us and our supplier that got held up, and we'd, you know, have to find the right codes. And it was quite a journey, to be honest, getting to the recipe. But, you know, so far, because our manufacturer is kind of bulk buying the pea protein, not just for us, but for a few different brands, whether they use it, you know, from in a kind of drinks capacity or a food capacity, and therefore, again, trying to minimize that supply chain impact. But because of that, it's a bit, little bit easier for us. So every time we go to production, it's ready in stock.
It's very interesting, this whole wider question of kind of pea-based protein, because possibly can it be used as a kind of bulking agent in other foods? I don't know, because the great problem with a lot of pre-prepared foods, and it's not entirely the fault of large manufacturers, is that the convenient bulking agent to use is, of course, sugar. And if there's an alternative to sugar, which is obviously, you know, with a lower glycemic index and more protein, I mean, that would be very, very good news indeed, beyond just drinks. The applications for this plant seem to be a bit wider.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're actually working with a vegan ice cream brand, which is great. It's called Yummy Chums. And they use our protein to thicken and, like you say, bulk up the ice cream. It tastes absolutely delicious. And it's actually free from the top 13 allergens as well. And so there's lots of different applications. I think we're really just at the tip of the iceberg with what we can do with pea protein. I think there's lots more things to come. Yeah, it's a very exciting journey to be on.
Which is your first export market of choice?
We actually have quite a few fans in Germany, and there's a real growing kind of vegan population over there, or indeed flexitarian. You know, a lot of them are just switching out certain things, and that's our kind of you know, is really important for me to kind of note that we're a vegan brand, but we're not just here for vegans, absolutely here for everyone. And so we're, you know, we're willing to work with lots of different people. And we've had quite a few kind of German tourists try our milk at various places and say, well, when are you coming to Germany? And so that kind of feels, and also our packaging, the head office is German as well. So it feels like that would be the right place to start, but we'd love to expand across Europe and further.
That'd be fantastic. And I suppose it's because you're a long life product, it's easier to do that than it would be with conventional milks. Although, having said that, I suppose you know it's not totally difficult to trade in milk, but it doesn't require refrigeration in transit. Is that right?
No, it doesn't. No, it's all ambient temperature, so it's a lot easier to transport and store than normal milk. So yeah, again, I think there's lots of opportunities. We've actually had quite a bit of interest from Asia as well, because they have lots of different milks there, but pea's not quite made it there, even though the pea protein that we use, you know, there's a variation of it that can grow and that does grow over in China as well. So that's quite interesting. But again, I just think plant-based milks and just plant food in general is just growing absolutely everywhere. It's not just, you know, a UK thing or a Western thing. It's a global phenomenon. And I think we're just going to see more and more of it. In the UK alone, we've got 1 in 3 Britons that will choose to buy plant milk, which is a huge number. We've got Veganuary approaching around the corner as well, which I think will hit record highs. And so, yeah, it's just a really exciting space to be in.
And by the way, I don't know who came up with Veganuary, but I mean, total respect to the person who came up with the idea that if you get people to do something for a month, you're halfway towards getting people to do it permanently or at least regularly. You know, I think I believe fairly confidently. I couldn't claim whether it's going to be 40 years or 50 years or most optimistically, maybe, you know, 25. But I think there will come a time when most of the developed world, at least, is largely meat-free. I'm not sure the whole world will go vegan, but I'm sure there'll be a time when we look back on the fact that people regularly ate dead animals in the same way that we kind of look back on things like slavery or indentured servitude or whatever it may be, that we'll look back on it as kind of, you know, really pretty odd and strange. I think that'll happen. What is interesting is the various different mechanisms. One friend of mine did research into this because he was always talking to either meat farmers or indeed dairy farmers who are ranting on about veganism or ranting on about vegetarianism. He said actually a very large part of the decline in meat consumption isn't really down to absolute religious vegetarianism. It's simply that people are eating more and more foods, e.g. pizza, which contain a pretty paltry amount of meat, where meat is a kind of garnish or a decoration. It's not the fundamental ingredient of the meal. And I think if you look at our eating habits, you know, we increasingly eat the kind of food where meat is not actually the center point of a meal. It's, you know, it's merely a constituent of it. So that reduces meat consumption. Then, of course, the interesting thing is when you have vegans, I never anticipated. I had vegan friends at university, which bear in mind, given that was in 1986, that was really pretty rare. But it was extraordinarily difficult to be a vegan if you wanted to eat out, for example. A pizza without cheese was a kind of slightly ridiculous meal, to be absolutely honest. And now, of course, they find it much easier. But it also changes the choice architecture because you're going to find that, you know, if you go and eat somewhere, there are probably going to be 2 vegan options and they're going to be 2 vegetarian options. I think there was a wrong turn probably taken by veganism and to some extent vegetarianism, as described by one of my vegetarian friends, who said that there was a time in the kind of 80s and 90s where vegetarian restaurants were almost for people who didn't like food. It was so closely bound up with the health food industry that it literally was kind of, you know, here's your spinach, you know. And of course, simple human ingenuity has started to produce things which are, as you said, dairy-free or meat-free, which are actually perfectly tasty, enjoyable, convenient, and non-weird. Do you think there's also scope? I'm interested in insect food. They're very, very high in protein. Okay. I think insects, you know, I wouldn't have the same qualms about killing insects as killing mammals. And they can also be farmed very, very environmentally friendly. Now, you may be uncomfortable with that, but it does strike me as an interesting possible development, which is that given that, you know, certain things, crickets, locusts, etc., in Mexico, you spice them up and they're a kind of snack. You can also powder them into flour because they're a great source of protein. You know, I've always wondered about that, whether, you know, my daughter, weirdly, who's vegetarian, is happy to eat bivalves. She's got some weird divide that they don't have a central nervous system. I've got another vegetarian friend who'll eat prawns, but nothing else. I think there might be an interesting case for drawing the line in interesting places as well.
It's a really interesting conversation, really, to have. I think it's all really boils down to personal beliefs and where that line is for you and the reason for you not eating a certain animal or, you know, whatever your diet may be. I think vegans would probably argue that, you know, it's just not right to kill anything that's living and that has a central nervous system, I guess. But it's an interesting debate to have, I think.
Honey used to be a dividing line for vegans, wasn't it? There were honey-eating vegans. And the argument is, although it's not an animal product, in that it doesn't come from an animal, you are exploiting the bees. And so honey, I remember being one source of argument. I've never quite seen the problem with eggs. Because if they're an unfertilized egg, and chickens don't eat eggs.
I think it's just the life cycle of an egg, the fact that they come from an animal, so they're deemed as an animal product, I guess. And it's also the kind of the farming that happens and the ways that the chickens are treated to get those eggs as well. I know there's been quite a lot of undercover cameras that have gone into farms and things that have shown that. And so it's kind of, I think, the bigger picture and the cruelty to the animals to get there as well. And veganism for me is a personal choice. But like I say, as a brand, it's not something that we kind of preach or judge anyone on. We're just here to offer an alternative.
It interests me as a behavioural change thing, because I think what we see is progress being made, not through absolutely sort of dogmatic persuasion, but through a variety of different things in the ecosystem, not least the quality of meat-free and plant-free food, but a whole variety of changes in behaviour happening, but all effectively working in the same direction. Having one vegetarian family member effectively turns the rest of the family flexitarian, if only through laziness. And that doesn't matter. You know, that doesn't matter. You're still, I often say, you know, it's what you do that counts. It's not why you do it in many ways.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think the point is that, you know, 5-10 years ago and more, you know, being vegan or vegetarian, you were simply just cutting things out of dishes. And so everything was free from, and you were left with, you know, whatever was left behind that was deemed vegetarian or vegan. But now having all these alternatives, you don't really feel like you're missing out. You still have an alternative. The innovative brands out there are creating things that taste more and more like what you're used to, if that is meat or creating. In terms of milk, we actually get a lot of feedback. A lot of people don't actually like the taste of milk or the taste it leaves behind on your tongue. And so, you know, we never really had that challenge in terms of, you know, we were never kind of thinking, well, we really want this to taste like milk, because it's not actually a very attractive in terms of taste. And so for us, it was a little bit easier in that way to kind of make our own mark and have something that tastes what we think is better than cow's milk. But you can still substitute it in all the ways that you would normally use it for. But I think that's the important thing, having alternatives so you still feel like you know, you can enjoy all the things that you always did, but just in a slightly different way that's better for your body and better for the planet.
You're right. So actually, the difference between, in a sense, being vegan or vegetarian, but certainly in my kind of youth, was a compromise rather than a choice. As you said, it was, you know, it was all about what you couldn't do. It wasn't about actually making a decision between two comparable alternatives. I think that's a really, really good insight. I mean, it's really, really useful. I'll end on this now and just say, you know, for all the people who've had their interest piqued, do give your URL by which they can order your product, or indeed any shops you want to name or distributors you want to name who stock it. This is a business that only created in 2020. It's one of the children of lockdown. And I just think it's a really wonderful story. So do plug yourself to the listeners.
Yeah, no, thank you very much, Rory. And we, yeah, so I mean, our website is thegoodpeaco.co.uk. So, you know, that's where you can, you know, try our products and you can sign up for subscriptions as well. So you can get, you know, really a really great package there. And we are in Replace London as well, which is in Westbourne Grove, really great health and wellness centre. And we're launching in a few.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Independent stores and like you say, a luxury kind of high-end store in London soon as well. So please have a look at all of our kind of our Instagram stories, follow us on social media. We're at The Good Pico, and you'll see all the kind of latest news and stockists and all the gossip that you need to know on there.
Well, Nikki, it's been great to chat to you. Thanks so much for joining me on the podcast today, and more power to you. I hope you go on from strength to strength. That's all for this episode of On Brand, but the podcast is brought to you by Alf Insight. And for more information on powering your business growth, just visit their website at alfinsight.com. That's alfinsight.com. This series is produced and marvellously edited by Ultimate Sound and Vision. And to make sure you receive the next episode, please do subscribe. And if you've enjoyed what you've heard, then again, help us algorithmically by giving us a like. All that remains to say is look forward to connecting with you next time. And thanks for listening.